From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
A Norfolk Mill Pond Mystery. Early one autumn afternoon, towards the end of the last century, Miss Smith and Miss Raven, fashion designers of a well-known firm in London, set out from a village in the valley of the Bur, Norfolk, for a tramp into the neighboring country. Both girls, for they were only girls, were typically modern. That is to say, they were bonny and athletic, and despite the sedentary nature of their vocations, extremely fond of outdoor life. Miss Raven, the elder of the two, was nice-looking, without perhaps being actually pretty. But Miss Smith was undeniably a beauty. Had she been a lady of title or an actress, all the society papers would have been full of her. She did not, however, crave for notoriety. She was quite content with the homage of most of the young men whom she knew, and the unspoken admiration of many men whom she did not know, but looked at her out of doors or sat near to her in theaters and restaurants. She was much attached to Miss Raven, and as the two strode along, swinging their arms, their tongues wagged merrily and without intermission. On and on, down one hill and up another, past wood and brook and hamlet they went, till a gradual fading of the light warned them that it was about time to think of turning back. "We must go as far as that old ruin," Miss Raven said, pointing to a tumbled-down white building that nestled close to a winding stream. "I've never seen anything quite so picturesque." "Even I've never seen anything quite so weird," Miss Smith replied. "I'm not at all sure I like it. Besides, I'm desperately thirsty. I want my tea. We'd much better go home." They had an argument, and it was eventually agreed that they should go on, but not beyond a certain point. "Not an inch further, mind you," Miss Smith said, "or I'll turn back and leave you." The ruin lay in a hollow, and just as the two girls descended the slope leading to it, a mist rose from the ground as if to greet them. They quickened their steps and, approaching nearer, perceived a mill wheel, the bare skeleton crowned with moss and ferns and dripping with slime. The pool into which it dripped was overgrown in places with reeds and chickweed, but was singularly bare and black in the center and suggestive of very great depth. Weeping willows bordered the stream, and their sloping, stunted forms were gradually growing more and more indistinct in the incoming mist. The space in front of the house, once no doubt a prettily cultivated garden, was now full of rank weeds and grass, and dotted here and there were as unsightly mounds consisting of fallen bricks and mortar. Some of these mounds, long, low, and narrow, were unpleasantly suggestive of graves, whilst the atmosphere of the place, the leaden-hued and mystic atmosphere, charged to the utmost with the smell of decayed trees and moldy walls, might well have been that of an ancient churchyard. A sense of insufferable gloom, utterly different from any they had ever before experienced, took possession of the two girls. "This place depresses me horribly. I don't know when I felt so sad," Miss Smith observed. "It's very stupid of me, I know, but I can't help thinking some great tragedy must have taken place here."
"I feel rather like that too," Miss Raven responded. "I've never seen such dreariness. Do you see those shadows on the water? How strange they are. There's nothing that I can see to account for them. There's certainly nothing the least like them in the sedge. There are none anywhere else. Look! Oh, do look. They're changing. They are completely different now. See? I'll throw a stone at them." Her throw, missing its mark, was so characteristically girlish that Miss Smith laughed. Miss Raven threw again, and this time a deep plomb announced her success. "There," she cried triumphantly. "Now do you see it?"
"I see something," Miss Smith answered. Then, with a sudden eagerness,
"Yes, you are right. The shadows are continually changing. They seem to separate themselves from the sedge and fall like live things into the pool. By the way, the pool seems to be growing darker and bigger. I don't like the place at all. For heaven's sake, let's get away from it. Miss Raven, however, was too fascinated. Stepping carefully, so as to avoid the mud and lawn grass, she went right up to the pool and peered into it. "How fearfully deep and still it is," she said. "What a beastly place to end one day's in." Then she gave a sudden cry. "Aileen, here! Come here, quick!" Miss Smith hastened up to her. "What is it?" she said. "How you frighten me." Miss Raven pointed excitedly at the water. It was no longer tranquil. The chickweed round the edges began to oscillate. White bubbles formed in the center, and then, quite suddenly, the entire surface became a seething, hissing, rushing, roaring whirlpool, which commenced rising in the most hideous and menacing manner. Seizing Miss Raven by the arm, Miss Smith dragged her back, and the two fled in terror. The fog, however, was so thick that they missed their way. They failed to strike the road, and instead found themselves plunging deeper and deeper into a fearful quagmire of mud and the rankest compound of rushes, weeds, and grass. They were just despairing of ever extricating themselves when Miss Smith felt a light tap on her shoulder, and swinging round, was almost startled out of her senses at the sight of a very white face glaring at her. Miss Raven, noticing that her companion had stopped, also turned round, and she too received a shock. The face she saw was so very white, the eyes, intently fixed on Miss Smith, so strangely luminous, the head covered with red, shaggy hair, so disproportionately large, and the figure, that of a hunchback youth, as a whole, so extraordinarily grotesque. He made no sound, but signing to them to follow him, he began to move away with a queer, shambling gait. The girls, thankful enough to have found the guide, however strange, kept close at his heels and soon found themselves once again on the roadway. Here the conductor came to a halt, and producing from under his coat what looked like a lady's reticule, he was about to thrust it into Miss Smith's hand when their eyes met, and to her intense astonishment, he uttered a bitter cry of disappointment and vanished. His action and disappearance were so inexplicable that the girls, completely demoralized, took to their heels and ran without stopping till the ruins were far in their rear and they were well on their way home. They related their experience to the people with whom they were staying, and were then told for the first time that the ruin was well known to be haunted. "Nothing will persuade any of the villagers to visit the mill pond after dusk," their hostess remarked, "especially at this time of the year, when they declare the water suddenly rises and follows them. The place has a most sinister reputation, and certainly several people, to my knowledge, have committed suicide there. The last to do so was Davy Dyer, the hunchback whose ghost you must have seen. He was rather a sad case, as I have good reason to know. Would you like to hear it?" The girls eagerly assented, and their hostess told them as follows. 10 years ago, there stood on that spot you visited this afternoon a very picturesque house called the Gip Mill. It was then extremely old, and as its foundations was faulty, it was thought a severe storm would sooner or later completely demolish it. Partly for this reason, and partly because the mill pool was said to be haunted, it stood for a long time untenanted. At last, it was taken by a widow named Dyer. Mrs. Dyer was quite a superior kind of person. She had at one time, I believe, kept a fairly good class girls' school in Bury St. Edmunds, but losing her connection through illness, she had been obliged to think of some other means of gaining a livelihood. When she came to the Gip Mill, she cultivated the garden and sold its produce, provided teas for picnic parties in the summer, and let out rooms chiefly to artists. She had one son, Davy, a very intelligent young boy, about 18, but hopelessly deformed. He was not only hunchback, but he had an abnormally large head, and what was quite unpardonable in the eyes of the village children, who tormented him shamefully, a mass of the brightest red hair. Well, one day a girl, whom I will call Beryl Denver, came to stay with me. Beryl was extremely pretty and horribly spoiled. She had gone on the stage against her parents' wishes and had been an immediate success. At the time I'm speaking of, she had just had an offer of marriage from a duke, and it was to hear what I had to say about it, for I am, I think, the only person for whom she ever asks advice, that she was paying me this visit. After being with me 3 days, however, and changing her mind with regard to the duke's offer, at least a dozen times, She suddenly announced that she must seek some more countrified place to stay in. "I want to go right away from everywhere," she said, "so that I can forget. Forget that there is such a place as London. Don't you know of any pretty cottage or picturesque old farm near here that I could stay at?" I suggested the Gyp Mill, and she started off at once to look at it. She came back full of enthusiasm. "It's a delightful spot," she said. "I'm glad I went to see it. The flowers are lovely, and the old woman's a dear. But I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stand that hunchback son of hers. His white face and big dark eyes alarmed me horribly. I don't think it's all right. He should be at large." "Poor Davy," I remarked. "His appearance is certainly against him. But I can assure you he is absolutely harmless. I know him well." Beryl shook her head. "You know my views, Auntie," she said. She always calls me Auntie, although I am not related to her in any way. "All ugly people have a kink of badness in them somewhere. They must be either cruel or spiteful or treacherous, or in some way or other evilly disposed. I'm quite certain that looks reflect the mind. No, I couldn't endure that boy. I can't stay there." In the morning, however, as I had fully anticipated, she changed her mind. A fly was sent for, and she drove off to the Gyp Mill, taking all her luggage with her. How Mrs. Dyer ever got it up her narrow staircase, I can't think, but she must have managed it somehow, for Beryl stayed, and, contrary to my expectations, for more than one night. Davy, she afterwards informed me soon, got on her nerves. Always, when she went out, she caught him covertly peeping at her from behind the window curtain of the little front parlor, and if ever she stood for a moment to chat with his mother, she could see him slyly watching her through a chink in the doorway. She had seldom, so far, met him out of the door, but as she was returning from a walk one afternoon, she came across a group of village children shouting at and jostling someone very roughly in their midst, and approaching nearer saw that the object of their abuse was Davy, and that in addition to pushing and pummeling him, they were tormenting him with stinging nettles, a very favorite device of the children in this district. Filled with disgust rather than pity, Beryl, like most modern girls, is wanting in real sentiment, and in this instance simply hated to think that anyone could derive amusement from so ungainly a creature. She interfered. "You abominable little wretches," she cried. "Leave him alone at once. Do you hear?" Had a bomb fallen, the children would not have been more surprised. One or two of the boys were inclined to be rude, but on the rest the effect of Beryl's looks and clothes, the latter in particular, were magical. Gazing at her open mouth, they drew back and allowed Davy to continue on his way. After this, Davy peeped more than ever, and Beryl, losing patience, determined to put a stop to it. Catching him in the act of following her through the fields one morning, she turned on him in a fury. "How dare you," she demanded. "How dare you annoy me like this? Go home at once." "This is my home, lady," Davy replied, his eyes on the ground and his cheeks crimson. "Then you must choose some other route," Beryl retorted. "And for goodness sake, don't be everlastingly looking at me. I can't stand it. No wonder those children rounded on you. She was going to call him some very strong name for Beryl, which roused didn't stick at trifles, but suddenly checked herself. She began to realize that this queer, distorted little object was in love with her. Now, no girl in London probably had more admirers than Beryl. Peers, politicians, authors, men of all vocations and classes had succumbed to her beauty, and she had deemed herself pretty well blasé. But here was a novelty. A poor, ostracized, rustic hunchback, the incarnation of ugliness and simplicity. "You know how the horrible fascinates one," she said to me later. "For instance, a nasty tooth or some other equally horrible defect in a person's face, which one keeps on looking at however much one tries not to. Well, it was a fascination of this kind that possessed me now. I felt I must see more of the hunchback and egg him on to the utmost." Apparently, it was owing to this fascination that Beryl, changing her tactics, encouraged Davy to talk to her, and assuming an interest in the garden, which she knew was his one hobby, gradually drew him out. Very shy and embarrassed, at first he could only very briefly answer her questions, but soon deceived by her manner, for Beryl could act just as cleverly off the stage as on it, he grew bolder and talked well on his favorite subject, natural history. He really knew a great deal, and Beryl, despite the fact that she could hardly tell the difference between a hollyhock and marigold couldn't help being impressed. She walked home with him that day, and for days afterwards she was often to be seen in his company. "He'll miss you dreadfully when you go, ma'am," Mrs. Dyer said to her. "He thinks the world of you. He told me last night that he only wished he could do something to show you how grateful he is for your kindness to him." Of course, Mrs. Dyer did not say that Davy was in love, but Beryl knew it. She knew that to him she was a deified being and that he absolutely adored her. Thus matters stood when a letter from the Duke made Beryl decide to leave Gyp Mill at once and return with all speed to London. She walked to the post office to dispatch a telegram, and Davy went with her. Beryl knew that this would be the last time in all possibility that she would ever walk with him, and feeling that she must find out how far this love for her had progressed, she agreed to his proposal that they should return home by a rather longer route. He wished, he said, to show her a garden which was by far the prettiest in all the country round, and it would not take them more than a quarter of a mile or so out of their way. Of course, Beryl looked upon this suggestion as a mere pretext on Davy's part for prolonging the walk, and she wondered whether he would say anything or whether his passion would be held in check by his natural respect for her superior social position. She was disappointed. Although she saw love for her shining more brightly than ever in his eyes, he did not speak of it. He talked only of flowers and of the great beauties of nature. Bored to distraction, she at last cut him short, and declaring that she had no time to waste, hurried on. It was not until they had reached home that she discovered that she had lost her reticule, containing not only a purse full of sovereigns, but the letter she had just received from the Duke. She distinctly remembered having it with her, she said, when Davy was prosing over the stupid flowers, and she supposed she must have left it somewhere in the garden, probably on the seat where they had sat for a few minutes. Davy, of course, went back at once to look for it, but when he returned an hour or so later, and in crestfallen tones told her that he could not find it, her anger knew no bounds. She did not actually call him a fool, but she made him clearly understand she thought him one, and he set off again almost immediately to have another look for it. He did not come back this time till close on midnight, and he had not the courage to tell her of his failure. His mother did it for him. Beryl went away early the next morning, too indignant to shake hands with either Mrs. Dyer or her son. "If Davy didn't actually take the reticule," she wrote to me some days later, "it was all owing to him, to his bothering me to see that rotten garden, that I lost it. But I firmly believe he has it. Ugly faces, you know, are indicative of ugly minds, of a bad kink somewhere." Of course, the affair of the reticule soon became public property. It was advertised for her in the local papers, and the woman in the post office told everybody that she remembered seeing it in Beryl's hands when she left the shop. Davy, she said, was with Miss Denver at the time, and I particularly noticed that he walked very close to her and watched her in a peculiarly furtive manner. The villagers with whom the Dyers had always been unpopular were not slow in taking up the cue, and consequently Davy, now waylaid by armies of children calling him thief and even beating him, never had a moment's peace. At last he was found one morning in the mill pond drowned, and it was generally believed that remorse for his sins had made him commit suicide. His mother alone thought otherwise. I did not see Beryl, nor hear anything of her, for at least 2 years after Davy's death, when to my complete surprise she drove up to the door one day with her usual pile of luggage. "Who is it this time?" I said, after we had exchanged greetings. "The Duke again?" "Oh dear, no," Beryl replied. "I broke it off definitely with him long ago. He was too boring for words, always dangling after me and never letting me go out with anyone else. If he had been tolerably good-looking, I might have stood it, but he wasn't. He was hopelessly plain. However, I made some use of him, and he certainly gave me good presents. I have been engaged several times since, and I have come now to ask your advice about the Earl of C., his eldest son. Shall I marry him or not? Do you think he's worth it?" I did not answer her at once, but let her ramble on, till she suddenly turned to me and said, "Do you remember the last time I was here, 2 years ago? You know I stayed at that delightful old mill house to gyp something, and lost my reticule. Well, I found it, some time afterwards, in my hat box. I hadn't taken it out with me that day after all, and I could have sworn I had. Wasn't it funny?" "Extraordinary, perhaps," I remarked, with rather more severity in my voice than I had ever used to her before, "but hardly funny." And I was about to relate to her all that had occurred in the interim, when something checked me. After all, I thought, it would be just as well for this spoilt, heartless little London actress to go to the gyp mill and find out for herself. "Well, I suppose I ought to have written to the people and let them know," she said carelessly, "but I was really too busy. I've always had much lots to do, such heaps of correspondence to attend to, and so many visits to make. If it's a fine day tomorrow, I'll walk over and explain." I did not, of course, expect Beryl would go, but greatly to my surprise, soon after luncheon, she came into my bedroom in her hat and coat. "I'm off," she said. "I think the walk will do me good. And look here, don't wait dinner for me, because in all probability I'll stay the night. It all depends upon how I feel. If I'm not back by 8, you need not expect me till tomorrow. Bye-bye." She stole to my side and kissed me, and, armed with an umbrella and Macintosh, set off up the street. I watched her till she turned a corner. Then I lay down and wondered what sort of reception she would meet with at the hands of Mrs. Dyer. As the afternoon waned, the sky grew ominously dark, and the wind rose. Presently, big drops of rain spluttered against the window, and there was every indication of a very severe storm. Had Beryl been on good terms with Mrs. Dyer, my mind would have been at rest, as she would have been able to take refuge at the mill. But knowing Mrs. Dyer's feelings toward her, I doubted very much if Mrs. Dyer would allow her to set foot within the house, and she would have some distance to walk before she could reach another shelter. Down came the rain in grim earnest, and that night witnessed the worst storm Norfolk had known for many years. Beryl did not return. I sat up till 12 wondering what had become of her, for despite this wayward child's many faults, I was much attached to her, and slept very little for the rest of the night. In the morning, my maid came to my room in a breathless state of excitement. "Oh, Mum," she exclaimed, "the storm has destroyed half Norfolk." This, of course, I knew to be an exaggeration. "What do you think? Simpkins' stores is blowed down. Nearly all the chimney pots are off in 4th Street, and the milkman has just told me the chip mill is under water, and Mrs. Dyer is drowned." "What?" I shrieked. "The chip mill under water? Are you sure? Miss Denver was staying there last night. Call a cab. I must go there at once." The maid flew, and I was feverishly scrambling into my clothes, when, to my utmost relief, in walked Beryl. "So you've heard," she said, looking rather pale but otherwise quite composed. "The chip mill valley is under water, and old Mrs. Dyer is drowned. It was rather lucky for me that I didn't go there after all, wasn't it? Quite a narrow escape, in fact." "Thank God you're safe," I exclaimed, drawing her into my arms and kissing her frantically. "Tell me all about it." "Oh, there isn't much to tell," she said. "When I got a mile or two on the road, I found I had quite forgotten the way. So I inquired of the person I met, a laborer, and he said, 'When you come to the duck pond, bear sharply to your left.' Well, I trudged on, and I'm sure I must have gone miles, but no duck pond, and I was beginning to despair of ever seeing it, when a sudden swerve in the road revealed it to me. The sky was very dark and threatening, and the wind, you know how I detest wind, sorely tried my temper. It was perfectly fiendish. Well, when I got to the pond, I found there were 2 roads, and I had quite forgotten which one of them I had to take. I was standing there shivering, feeling horribly bored, when to my joy a figure suddenly hove in view. It had grown so dark that I could not make out whether the stranger was a man or a woman. Besides, I couldn't see a face at all, only a short, squat body, clad in some sort of ill-fitting, fustian garment. I shouted out, 'Can you tell me the way to the gyp mill?' But could get no reply. The strange creature simply put out one hand, and taking the road to the right, beckoned to me to follow. Then I suddenly remembered that the other person, the laboring man, had told me to take the road to the left. And I ran after the curious-looking individual, shouting, 'The gyp mill! Do you hear? I want to go to the gyp mill, Mrs. Dyer's.' Again, I got no response. But the hand waved me on more vigorously than before. It was now so dark that I could hardly see where I was treading, and the wind was so strong that I had the greatest difficulty in keeping my feet. I battled on, however, and after what seemed to me an eternity, we eventually stopped outside a building that showed a twinkling light in one of the windows. My conductor opened a wicket gate, and signing to me to follow, walked me up a narrow winding path to the front door. Here he halted, and turning suddenly round on me, showed his face. It was the Dyer boy, Davy. I think they called him Davy the Hunchback. Here Beryl paused. 'Are you quite sure?' I asked. "Absolutely," she replied. "I couldn't mistake him. There he was, with his hunchback, huge head, cheeks looking whiter than ever, and red hair." How I could see that it was red in the dark, I can't tell you, but all the same, I could. And moreover, the color was very clear and distinct. Well, he stood and looked at me for some seconds beseechingly, and then said something, but so quickly I couldn't catch what it was. I told him so, and he repeated it, jabber, jabber, jabber. Then I grew angry. "Why have you brought me here?" I shouted. "I wanted to go to the gyp mill." He spoke again in some incomprehensible way, and holding out his hand as if to implore my forgiveness, suddenly disappeared. Where he went to is a mystery. The rain had now begun to fall in torrents, and to attempt to go on was madness. Consequently, I rapped at the door and asked the woman who opened it if she could put me up for the night. "Yes, miss," she said, "we have a spare room, if you don't mind it being rather small. The gentleman has been staying here, left this morning." "Did anyone recommend you?"
"Mr. Dyer brought me here," I said, "and I believe he's somewhere outside."
"Mr. Dyer?" the woman exclaimed, looking at me in the oddest manner. "I don't know a Mr. Dyer."
"Who do you mean?"
"Why, Davy Dyer," I replied, "the son of the old woman who lives at the mill. Davy Dyer, the hunchback." Then, to my amazement, the woman caught me by the arm. "Davy Dyer, the hunchback," she cried. "Why, miss, you must either be dreaming or mad. Davy Dyer drowned himself in the mill pool 2 years ago."
The Headless Woman of the Churnet. In the valley of the Churnet, and not very far from the banks of that sinuous river, is another hollow that was at one time rumored to be haunted. It lies between the villages of Doveridge and Sudbury on the road connecting them with Derby. A stream running into the Churnet crosses it, and on either side of it are high banks crowned with hedges. Behind the hedges are trees, whose wide-spreading branches almost meet above the roadway. On a hot summer's day, the spot may be described as pleasantly shady, but at nighttime, and even on an autumn or winter's afternoon, it is depressing, and one is glad to move away from it quickly as possible. About the middle of the last century, a wagoner had the following strange experience there. He had gone to a fair at Derby, and it was late when he set out on his homeward journey. At the bottom of the cart was a quantity of straw that had been used for packing cheese. He sat down on it and made himself as comfortable as he could. The mare neither rode well, and being anxious to get home, stepped out at a brisk pace. Being very tired, the eternal rattle-rattle of the wheels and the clatter-clatter of the mare's hoofs seemed to have a soothing effect on him, and he eventually fell asleep. He awoke with a violent start just in time to prevent the reins from being torn from his grasp by the mare, who had apparently taken fright at something and was shying for all she was worth. Maintaining his seat with difficulty, he looked round and saw at a glance he was in the hollow already described. But what attracted his attention at once and made his heart almost stand still with horror was a tall figure standing on the bank on the side of the road. The moonlight poured down on it through a parting of the great gnarled branches overhead and rendered every detail terribly distinct. It was the figure of a woman, but a woman without a head. Where the head would have been was merely space, the trunk terminating in a protuberance of neck. All this he took in at a glance, but ere he had time to observe more, the mare bolted, and when she assumed a normal trot again, the hollow was gone some miles in the rear, and he could see the Churnet gleaming like polished silver in the far distance. The Head, a Derbyshire pretty ghost. Some years ago, two men were trudging along a road in Derbyshire, swearing heartily. It was not the first time they had sworn, not by any means, but it is extremely doubtful if either of them had ever sworn before quite so vehemently. There were, one must admit, extenuating circumstances. Having missed the last train, they were obliged to walk home a distance of 12 or more miles, and having been overtaken by a rainstorm, they were soaked to the skin. True, the rain had now ceased, but as they covered only 6 miles, they still had 6 more to go, and at every step they took, the water in their boots soaked through their socks and squelched between their toes. Just as they arrived at a spot where the road swerved a little to their left and took a sudden dip, a clock from a distance solemnly chimed 12. The younger of the two men came to a halt and lighted his pipe. "Hold on a minute, Brown," he shouted. "I can't keep up this infernal pace any longer. Let's take it easy." Brown turned and joined his companion, who had seated himself on a wooden gate. Below them, in the dip, the darkness was sepulchral.
The hedges on either side of the road were of immense height, and high above them rose the trunks of giant pines and larches, the intertwining branches of which formed an archway that completely obliterated the sky. A faint speck of light from afar flickered occasionally, as if through a gap in the foliage, but apart from this the men could see nothing, nothing but blackness. "A cheerful spot," Brown remarked, "as gloomy a bit of road as I've ever seen." The other man blew his nose. "Not so quiet now," he laughed, "but how everything echoes. What's that? Water?" Both men looked, and apparently, from the other side of the hedge came the gentle gurgle of quick-flowing water. There was something so eerie in the sound that both men shivered. "Must be a spring," Brown said, "flowing into a stream close to us. The darkness and eeriness of the spot suggest the Styx. I'm sure it is badly haunted." "A match, if you please, Reynolds." Reynolds gave him one, and for a while the two men puffed away in silence. Suddenly something whizzed overhead, and they heard the prolonged, dismal hooting of an owl. "This is getting a bit too eerie, even for my liking," Brown Reynolds remarked. "Suppose we move on. I always associate noises like that with a death." "I wish it were my mother-in-law's," Brown laughed, "or my own, but there's no such luck. I'm cold." "So am I," Reynolds replied. "Deuced cold. Come on, do." He slid off the gate as he spoke and strode into the center of the road. The moon, temporarily unveiled, revealed as wet a landscape as one could possibly imagine. Everything dripped water, bushes, trees, ferns, grass, huts, clothes, whilst every rut of the road, every particle of soil, shone wet in the moon's rays. A deep, settled calm permeated the atmosphere. It was the stillness of night and moisture combined. "What's the matter? Aren't you coming?" Brown asked impatiently. "One moment," Reynolds replied. "I believe I heard footsteps. Hark! I thought so. They're coming this way. Someone lost their train, perhaps." Brown listened, and he too distinctly heard the sound of footsteps. High-heeled shoes walking along with a sharp, springy action, as if the road were absolutely hard and dry. "A woman!" he ejaculated. "Odd hour for a woman to be out here." Brown laughed. "Pooh," he said. "Women are afraid of nothing nowadays except old age. Hello, here she comes." As he spoke, the figure of a woman, slight and supple, and apparently young, shot into view, and came rapidly towards them. Her dress, though quaint and pretty, was not particularly striking, but her feet, clad in patent leather shoes with buckles that shone brightly in the moonlight, were oddly conspicuous, in spite of the fact that they were small and partially hidden beneath a skirt which was long and frilled, and not at all in accordance with the present fashion. Something about her prevented both men from speaking, and they involuntarily moved nearer to one another as she approached. On and on she came, tripping along and never varying her pace, now in a zone of moonlight, now in the dark belt of shadows from the firs and larches. She drew nearer and nearer. Through the hedge, Brown could dimly perceive the figure of a cow, immensely magnified, standing dumb and motionless, apparently lost, like he was, in spellbound observation. The silence kept on intensifying. Not a breath of air, not a leaf stirring, not a sound from Reynolds, who stood with arms folded like a statue, only a subdued trickle-trickle of the spring and the hard tap-tap-tap of the flashing, sparkling shoes. At last the woman was abreast of them. They shrank back and back, pressing further and further into the hedge, so close that the sharp twigs and brambles scratched their faces and tore their clothes. She passed, down, 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 still tripping daintily, until a sepulchral blackness of the dip swallowed her up. They could still hear her tap, 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 and for some seconds neither spoke. Then Reynolds, releasing his clothes from the thorns, muttered huskily, "At last I've seen a ghost, and I always scoffed at them." "But her head," Brown ejaculated, "where was it?" "Don't ask me," Reynolds replied, his teeth chattering. "She had no head, at least I didn't see one. There you go now." "What, down there?" Brown said, nodding in the direction of the dip. "Well, we must, if we are to get home tonight," Reynolds retorted, "and I'm frozen." "Wait till that noise ceases then," Brown answered. "I can't stand seeing a thing like that twice in one night." They stood still and listened, until the tapping gradually died away in the far distance, and the only sound to be heard was that of the water, the eternal, never ceasing, never varying sound of the water. Then they ran. Ran as they had never run since long ago Rugby days, down through the inky darkness of the hollow and out, far out into the brightness of the great stretch of flat country, and all the time they ran they neither looked to the right nor to the left, but always on the ground just ahead of them. For a week the horror of what they had seen was so great that neither of the two men could bear to be alone in the dark, and they kept a light in their respective rooms all night. Then a strange thing happened. Brown became infatuated. He did nothing but rave all day about the ghost. She had the prettiest figure, the whitest hands, the daintiest feet he had ever seen, and he was sure her face must be equally lovely. Why couldn't he see it? There was nothing about the neck to show she had been decapitated, and yet the head was missing. Why? He worried Reynolds to death about it, and he gave no one any peace. That waist, those delicate white fingers, those rosy almond-shaped nails, those scintillating shoe buckles, they got on his brain. They obsessed him. He was like a maniac. At last, at the suggestion of Reynolds, who wanted to get rid of him for a while, he went to London and paid visits to most of the professional mediums and occultists in the West End. Some advised him one thing, and some another. Some immediately went into trance and learned from their controlling spirits all about the headless phantom, whom she was, why she paraded the high road, and what had become of her head. No two told him alike, and the head he so longed to see had at least a dozen different hiding places. He contacted at last a medium who, for a moderate fee, agreed to hold a seance in the place where they had seen the ghost. He closed with the offer. When the night fixed for the seance arrived, the weather conditions were all that could be desired. The air was soft and calm, the moon brilliant, the sky almost cloudless, and promising only the finest weather for days to come. As the medium insisted on a party of at least four, Brown persuaded Mr. and Mrs. Roscovy, Russians, to come, and they all sat up together shortly after 10 o'clock. Brown had made many inquiries into the neighborhood as to the phantom figure, but he had only come across two people who would tell him anything about it. One, a farmer, assured him that he had on several occasions seen the ghost when driving, and that on such occasion it had kept abreast of his horse, even though the latter was careering along the road half mad with fright. But what terrified him most, he said, was that the apparition had no head. The other, a blacksmith, said he had seen the woman twice, and that each time he had seen her she had been carrying something tucked under her arm, which he had fancied was a head. But he had been too scared to look at it very closely, and he only knew for certain that where her head should have been there was nothing. Both he and the farmer said they had heard all their lives that the road was haunted, but for what reason they had never been able to discover, as within the past 60 years, at any rate, neither murder nor suicide was known to have taken place near the hollow. This is as far as Brown had got with his investigations when he set out on the night in question. The Roscovies did not think for one moment that the ghost would appear. They said few people apparently had seen it. Its visits in all probability were only periodical, and weeks, months, or even years might elapse before it put in an appearance there again. That may be, but then we have a medium, Brown argued. I engaged it to invoke the ghost, provided it would not come of its own accord. You can invoke it, can't you, Madame Valenspin? Madame Valenspin now seemed rather dubious. I have never tried in the open before, she said with a slight shiver, but I will do my best. The conditions seem favorable, but I can't say definitely till we arrive at the exact spot. Brown, however, could not help observing that the further they advanced into the country, which became more and more lonely, the more restless and uneasy Madame Valenspin grew. Once or twice she halted, as if irresolute whether to go on or not, and the moment she caught sight of the hollow, she came to a dead stop. "Not down there," she said. "It's too dark. We'd better stay here." The silence was only broken by the gurgling of the spring, which sounded more eerie than ever. Behind it, away back in the broad expanse of field were cattle, their skins startlingly white, all motionless, and all in attitude suggestive of a sense of anticipation, of a conscious waiting for something. The sepulchral hush was uninterrupted, save by bats, assuredly the biggest and blackest Brown had ever seen, wheeling and skimming with the faintest perceptible whiz, whiz, whiz in and out of the larches, and the soft intermittent fanning of the leaves as the night breeze came rustling over the flat country and continued its career down into the hollow. A rabbit scurried across the farm from one gate to another, its white breast shining silver, and some other small furry creature,
of a species undetected created a brief pandemonium in a neighboring ditch. Otherwise, all nature was extraordinarily passive. The figure went right down into the hollow, Brown said. I think we ought to try there. What do you think, Mrs. Roscovy?
I am of the same opinion as Madame Valenspin, Mrs. Roscovy replied, glancing apprehensively at the dip. I think we had better stay where we are.
Very well, then, Brown said. Let's begin. You are mistress of the ceremonies, Madame Valenspin. Will you tell us what to do? For a minute, everyone was silent. Madame Valenspin was ghastly pale. She moved to one side of the road. Many years ago, she said, in a voice strangely unlike her own, a ghastly crime was committed in the hollow. Two sisters in love with the same man met there one day. They quarreled, and in the struggle that ensued, one sister pushed the other into the stream. She was swept away and drowned. The murderess, who was never suspected, lived for many years after the cruel deed. On her death, she was doomed to haunt the scene of the crime. Prepare for a shock. She ceased speaking. Hardly had she done so when from the hollow came the eerie sound of footsteps, a measured tap, tap, tap on the hard ground. Everyone became tense and listened with bated breath. The tapping grew more and more audible, and presently there emerged from the gloom and the shadows of the dip the same dainty figure that Brown and Reynolds had seen on the previous occasion.
It is she! It is she! Brown exclaimed excitedly. The slim waist to the slender arms, those lovely hands and shoes with the buckles, how they sparkle! I must see her head. I will see it! An exclamation of horror interrupted him. It was from Mr. Roscovy. He had moved to one side of the road, dragging his wife with him, and the two were standing huddled together, their eyes fixed in a frenzied stare at the phantom's neck. Brown, forcing his attention away from the long, slim hands which so fascinated him, followed their glance. The neck was not as he remembered it, white and slender as far as it went, but it ended abruptly in a gray nothingness, and beyond this nothingness, Brown fancied he discerned the dimmest of shadows. He was appalled but fascinated. An intense curiosity far outweighed his fear. He was certain she was beautiful, beautiful to a degree that immeasurably excelled any feminine loveliness he had hitherto encountered. He must see her face. He did not believe her head was missing. He believed it was there on her body right enough, but that for some specific reason it had not materialized. He turned to Madame Valenspin to inquire the cause, and was greatly astonished to see her beating a hasty retreat across the fields. The figure had now come up to where he was standing, and tripping past him, it sped swiftly down the dip. Brown at once gave chase. He had not gone many yards before the darkness of the dip was on him, and the only clue he had to his quarry's whereabouts was the sound of the shoes, the constant tap, tap, tapping. On and on he went, however, and at length, emerging from the darkness, he perceived a wooden stile, and beyond it a tiny path threading its way through a clump of firs that gradually grew thinner and thinner till they finally terminated in what appeared to be a broad clearing. Mounting the stile and springing off on the other side, the woman tripped along the path, and turning for a moment to beckon Brown, disappeared from view. The intense loneliness of the spot, emphasized a thousandfold by the eerie effect of the few straggling moonbeams that fell aslant the stile and pathway, and the knowledge that he had left his companions far behind, made Brown falter, and it was some seconds before he could gather up the courage to continue his pursuit. A light, girlish laugh, however, proceeding apparently from the spot where the figure had vanished, determined him. He saw once again, vividly before him, that willowy waist, those slim, delicate fingers, and those coquettish little feet. Were the devil itself to bar his way, he must see her face. Sweating with terror, and yet with all obsessed with a passion that defies description, Brown mounted the stile and hastened in the direction of the laugh. Again it rung out, charged to overflowing with innocent fun and frolic, irresistibly girlish, irresistibly coy. This time it came from behind a clump of trees bordering on the dip stream. Wild with excitement, mad with love, Brown rushed by the trees and abruptly halted. Floating in the air over the stream was the head he had longed to see. Hair, nose, and mouth were lovely, but not the eyes, because there were no eyes, just empty, gaping, glittering cavities. As Brown stood staring at the ghastly spectacle, aghast, There was a girlish giggle.